for another special edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I'm Bob Carpenter, founder of Inside Lacrosse Magazine, and we are continuing to throw that deep ball. There are more full-length conversations to be had here with Syracuse greats on this program's 100th anniversary. Roy Simmons Jr., this guy is classic, so full of knowledge and so hilarious. Matt Palin once called him the sports Jack Nicholson. Today, I kind of think of him more like the sports Mark Twain. After writing our coffee table book in 2000, I had to figure out who to ask to pen the foreword, and it took about half a second to come up with that name. The best part about doing that project was the mini book signing tour that Coach and I took, where I was the lucky recipient of many hours of his stories. Coach Simmons, his stories, they always have a punchline, they're always hilarious, they're always meaningful, and they're only ever just in part about lacrosse. All you have to do to have a great conversation with Coach is treat him like he would treat one of his players. You just roll the ball out on the turf, or in this case, pick up the telephone. You just give him the ball. Along with Dick Adell, I put Coach Simmons above all other coaches in the category of being eternally loved by his former players. So here we go. Another conversation. This time, it might be my favorite conversation. Roy Simmons Jr. We are joined by a true legend of the sport, the iconic Coach Roy Simmons Jr. How are you, sir?
Fine, Robert. Thank you very much. And I like the work you've been doing. I think that's terrific. You stay involved.
Inside Lacrosse had a wonderful relationship the past 20 years because we cover the biggest, loudest, most fun personalities, the stuff that fans enjoy the most. And that has been the lion's share of you guys.
Well, people love a winner, and they love an up-tempo game. I had a friend called the Carrier Dome that made both the spectators and the players a little bit better. It was warm, it was predictable, it was easily accessible, and I think a lot of my success had to do with how we play and where we play. And someone said once, what's it take to be a great coach? And someone said, that's a simple answer, great talent. So if you get great talent, and I had great talent, I owe it to them for the wins we had, and I owe it to the community, the city of Syracuse, and the university for where we could play and how we could play. So it's been a great run, 100th anniversary, and I'm 80 years old. So 80 of those years I've been around, and all the way from being a kid mascot on the team where my feet didn't touch the ground when I sat on the bench. I traveled with the team as I got older, and I became a player here at Syracuse. In my college years, I became the freshman coach and then the varsity coach. And my dad kept me grounded all through my life. You know, he would give me congratulations and give me a hug, but then he always had something to say afterwards. And I guess it, you kind of alluded to the poem he read to me the next day after my first championship. Whether he penned it or not, he said, you know, from little rays of sunshine come little blades of grass. Today a college hero, tomorrow a horse's ass. Even though I was coach of the national championship team, he let me know, you know, things can change and you got to work hard to keep them the same.
Like you said, you've been around the program for 80 years.
Yeah.
Your dad was the coach, and it seems like it's such a smooth, gradual transition. Did you ever have a point in your life where you stopped and said, this is the coach I want to be?
Well, my dad was very charismatic. My house was always a joy, and our dining room table was always a playing field, and he would move the salt and pepper shaker around and show me different plays that he liked and what he was going to do and who we were going to play. And it was a friendly atmosphere. Very often, the opposing coaches would come to the house. Back then, we were a little more friendly than today, I guess. And it was just a good life, and I didn't have any problem saying, well, why should I change it, or can I make it any better? And I'm in on the ground floor, you know, and he would take me to work, and work meant going to a gymnasium for boxing and football stadium for football in the fall, and in the spring I'd go on all the lacrosse trips and be the coach's son up and down the aisle on the bus, and the kids gave me a lot of attention, played catch with me, and it was almost part of my blood. And I didn't see any reason to move any other direction.
People talk about you not being the guy on the ground going on all the recruiting trips, but sort of the figurehead. Yeah. Were you an X's and O's guys earlier? Was that something that you and your dad would talk about?
Well, we did talk X's and O's, but then I realized the other guy, he knew a lot about you also, and he was going to try and trip you up if he could. Every time you walked into an opposing stadium, they had a playbook on you. You know, I used to find them in locker rooms afterwards. It was almost predictable, so I felt like being free-spirited as an artist. If I entered the stadium with my team and I was a little more unpredictable, then maybe they'd struggle with me a little more.
Was there ever a playbook you found where they were talking about how to defend Jim Brown?
No, I never found one on Jim Brown. I think it was kind of a given. You got to deny him the ball. The bad thing that I remember about Jim vividly, because I played with him, was they would use racial languages on the field where nobody in the crowd could hear it, but they would get up next to him and say bad things, as they will, as they did back then. And he would not ever be angered. I never knew him to ever get in a fight, so to speak. All he'd do is, if you abused him racially, verbally, he would just take the ball and go to the goal, and he could score at will. And if you did that to him, if you tried to pull a race card on him, that's the worst thing you could do, because then he played bigger and better than he ever had.
What was it like meeting him? I mean, did you know that it was a legend in the making?
Well, he came to Syracuse by way of a lacrosse alum, and he told my dad, you know, Simi, we got this young kid, and he is a phenomenon. He is unstoppable. He is the greatest athlete I've ever seen, and I want him to come to my or our alma mater, and we got to get him up there to play football, and he's a great lacrosse player, and then in the off season, the spring, he can play for you. So we went to the head football coach at the time, and he wasn't interested. And so my dad said, well, we got to get him here and let him go out for football as a walk-on, not as a scholarship player, but as a walk-on student. And so my dad gave what money he had for lacrosse, and then we talked to the track coach, because Big Jim ran track also, and we got some money from him, and then they passed the hat, and we got together enough tuition, room, and board, and he came to Syracuse in the fall of 52, I guess it was. He was a 16-year-old freshman, and big and strong. And he was going to come to Syracuse and prove to our football program that he belonged on it. In those days, we had freshman football. You couldn't play varsity by rule of NCAA law. So he went out for football, and, of course, he went out, and first they made an end out of him, and they thought about making him an interior lineman because he was like 235 and 6'2" at that time. That was sizable, and he wasn't very well received, but he had to prove to that football coach that he was worthy of a scholarship. Otherwise, he wasn't going to be able to come back, you know, to Syracuse as a sophomore. So he made the freshman team all right, and he was a star for the freshman, and the head football coach looked at him and said, well, I guess I'll take my chance. I'll give him a football scholarship. So he didn't have a football scholarship until he was a sophomore. And then, of course, they found out that he's been better off in the backfield as a running back, and the rest is history. And then the whole world saw him with the Cleveland Browns, and he set all those records, and they'll never be broken. He loved my dad. My dad had him assistant football coach. He had him. My dad tried to get him to go out for the boxing team, and he didn't want any part of that. But my dad had him in lacrosse, so he had him two seasons a year, and he got to liking my dad. My dad was like a father they didn't have, and so the relationship between my father and Jim Brown was very tight. Jim still to this day talks very fondly of my father. He was there for him always, and come his senior year, he could have signed a pro contract with the Cleveland Browns in May. School was out in June. Lacrosse season went on, and Jim said, you know, to Paul Brown, I'm not going to sign a contract yet. I want to play for Simi. I'm going to play lacrosse. That's what lacrosse and Syracuse and my father meant to Big Jim.
I've seen a clip of him playing. He picked up a faceoff. He cradled it down around his feet and, like, turned the corner and started running. That's all I've seen. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine him just running through people, and I can imagine him being tough to get by defensively. But can you describe in more detail what his style of play was?
I have the bumps and bruises to prove how tough he was. See, I played the same position as he did as a freshman, sophomore, I played midfield and I played center. And that's what he was. He was a faceoff guy. And I was on the second team. And every day we would scrimmage, first team against the second team. So I played against Jim Brown Monday to Friday in afternoon practices. And he'd run at you. And you had a choice, either step out of the way and kind of look like a coward or stand there and get mowed over. I felt that with Jim Brown's career at Syracuse, he probably knocked me down more than any other athlete because he did it Monday to Friday when he played against, some football player from another team. He played him once in a season on a Saturday afternoon. He would go to football practice, spring football, and I would carry a stick and glove and helmet to the lacrosse practice. And after he finished his tour of duty in spring football, he'd come running over to the lacrosse field, take off his football pad and helmet, and I'd hand him a stick and his helmet, and then he'd finish the day off playing lacrosse. But he was never timed to the 40. I can remember when the pros, the NFL, came through with Bennett and say, "I don't know." He said, "You've coached this guy for 4 years, and you don't know how fast he is? You never timed him?" And he said, "No, he would never allow me to time him. He refused. He just ran as fast as he had to. If you look at football films, you know, he's running down the sideline, some guy's got the right angle on him geometrically, and you say he's going to shove him out of bounds, and then Jimmy just put in another gear. And he ran as fast as he had to run, but no faster. He was always conserving energy. If you saw him in the NFL football, when he got tackled, he was always slow getting up. It was almost like he was hurt.
Yeah.
He wasn't hurt. He was never hurt. He would get up slow, and he'd take his time. He was conserving that energy. He had he was master at that. He could run forever. He tired was not a word in his vocabulary. And he had a lacrosse stick in his hand long before he touched a basketball or a football or a javelin. He threw the javelin also. So he was ambidextrous in the mid-50s, which was unheard of. He played hard, and he ran hard, and the result was on the scoreboard. His senior year, my junior year, we were undefeated. Jim did play in the North-South game, and the people are still talking about it in Baltimore. He was just fabulous at everything he did. I've been to a lot of social things with him, with Floyd Little and John Mackey and Larry Sanka and all the great football players that played here. And everybody's talking, and then all of a sudden Jim walks in the room, and a hush comes over the room. And it's almost like, you know, you expect to look at the Messiah. He has a way of walking there. He would have been a great politician.
An item you mentioned before in relation to Jim was this sort of Teflon nature where people were giving him a hard time and he wouldn't like fight back. I always tell people that out of all of Gary Gate and Paul Gates' attributes, there's the fact that he used to get doubled and triple teamed and slammed. I've never seen Gary Gate like push back.
I coached him for 4 years, and I saw him, cross-checked and blindsided and double-teamed, and you see him in the locker room afterwards heading for the shower. It'd make your eyes water to see the abrasions and bumps and bruises all over his body, and never once did I ever see him swear or lose his temper, ever swing. When after his college career, he went to Canada and played box lacrosse. They had a player on his team who was assigned just to protect him and make sure nobody really hurts him. That's how much of a target he was. But neither Paul nor Gary, I never heard either one of them swear or ever swing. They don't have a violent streak in them, and they have every reason to say, hey, and it's payback time, but they don't feel that way about it. And they know that they are who they are. They play the game hard, and it's acceptable.
So that was never anything that was instilled. That's just them naturally.
Right.
Or did you coach that into them?
Well, you know, I know that they're going to be a target. The beauty I had with Paul and Gary was I had two. People used to say it's like having Michael Jordan and a brother. I had two, so you really couldn't concentrate on one. I guess the most famous game with that in mind was Johns Hopkins versus Syracuse in 1989. They took a great defenseman, first team All-American, Dave Petromella, and they changed his position for that day, that game, and they put him on Gary Gate and to shut him down, shut him off, deny him the ball or take the ball away. And what they didn't realize was He had a brother named Paul. And Petro did a great job on Gary. Didn't the whole scoreless, but he did a great job, which did kind of put a wrinkle in our plan. But we had Paul, and Paul stepped up along with another middie.
You have Rodney Thompson, too, and you had Brad Roos on the second line.
But Petro couldn't watch them all. And he was the third middie. He threw in the winner, but he didn't get credit for it. You know, I couldn't have all three be first team midfield, because then I would have owned the midfield with Gary and Paul and Rodney. So poor Rodney would have been a first team midfielder anywhere. But he was playing with Paul and Gary, and he kind of got lost in the shuffle.
Let's just talk for a second about Paul Gate. Everybody knows Gary Gate, mm-hmm. and I think everybody in the world knows the Gate brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, everybody knows that Paul, if he's not on Gary's level, he is a hair below it. You know, he didn't have the longevity in the NLL and some stuff like that.
Right.
But I remember him being so clutch in the Penn game, in the Carrier Dome, in the Final Four, right. when he scored that yeah. goal with like 15 seconds left or something like that.
Right.
I was in the stands, and I'm like, that's going to end up being one of the great lacrosse plays of all time. But I don't
right.
remember a lot of people talking about that play. Just what are your thoughts on Paul Gate?
Well, Paul came through with the clutch. You know, when they first came here, I was in my office one day, and Paul came to the office. He had a tennis racket in his hand. He'd been out some tennis court somewhere playing, and he was wringing wet with sweat, and he just gotten off the courts. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Playing tennis against Gary." I said, "Oh, really? Who won?" He looked at me and said, "What do you mean, who won? In my whole life, identical twins, you know, their mother couldn't tell them apart. They're that identical." He said, "We've always played against one another. And whatever we do, Gary always wins." It was almost like Gary had his number or really had him talked into it, you know. But he's just a shade behind. And when it came to a critical situation, which it certainly did in the Penn game, the game you mentioned, and it did in the 89 championship game against Hopkins, Paul came through when he had to. When somebody stepped on his brother too hard, then he came alive, and he was as good a player as he was on the field.
I remember him also in one of the early MLL championships. I think he was playing for the Lizards, and mm-hmm. at that point he was not as mobile as he was before. And he just sat on the crease playing attack. And, he had that last-second clutch goal. And I think all those MLL guys respected him so much and knew that just whipping – all you had to do was whip the ball in the general direction of Paul Gate, mm-hmm. and it was going to bounce off like a pinball and just go in the goal. You know, he would handle anything, and he would finish anything.
Well, you know, they both took a pretty good beating, and they both have had – a little nagging problems. They've had these minor surgeries, taking granulated bone chips out of their elbows and shoulder and their ankles, you know. And Paul was the subject of a lot of those little annoying hits and bumps that cost you along the way. You can't take a beating as they took and not go unnoticed, you know. Paul also was a very, very clever. So Paul very quietly has been designing lacrosse equipment ever since he graduated. He's designed gloves and pads of all kinds, sticks, handles, stringing. He's a very complex and very interesting person, and he's given as much to the sport as Gary has as a coach. Paul has given back as far as contemporary equipment. He's not on the scoreboard, but in the sport, he's very, very important. And I hope someday people will realize he has never stopped loving lacrosse or being involved in it ever since the day he carried his first stick.
In the year, maybe 89, maybe 90, at Vestal, we would run around and videotape anything we could, any lacrosse games. And there was a program from a local sports station in Syracuse. And you were on. Mm-hmm. What you talked about next was your up-and-coming recruit, Charlie Lockwood. Mm-hmm. And there were some clips of Charlie shooting. And you said, "Yeah, he's going to be an Orangeman next year. He's coming our way." And we were mm-hmm. all so jealous of Charlie Lockwood. and then the story, I think you called him the Laser, or the sportscaster called him the
right.
Laser. And then I heard the story about him coming either on a recruiting trip or him coming to school, and you kind of threw it down as a challenge. You put the 22 jersey in front of him and said, "I want you to wear it. Do you have the courage to pick it up?" Is that story folklore, or is that accurate?
Oh, no, that's true. You know, like a lot of kids, they get superstitious when they're in high school. They underneath their jersey, they got their favorite T-shirt on, maybe from a Grateful Dead or whatever it is. They have these little superstitions. Well, Charlie had a superstition, very successful in high school All-American. And he had a number, and I don't remember the number now, but it was not 22. He didn't ever want to give it up because it meant so much to him, and he was so successful with it. So I had that number on a Syracuse jersey, and I had, in the other hand, I had number 22. And we were walking out to the first game, and I was walking with him. It was just he and I. And we got out to the field, and I said, Charlie, it's about time to put on a jersey here. And I threw his high school number jersey on the field in front of him, and then I threw 22 down, and I said, you know, it's going to be a Syracuse jersey, and you can have either number you want. But if you had any pride, any guts, you'd pick up number 22 and put high school behind you. And then I stepped forward and I walked away. And he hadn't had a chance to make up his mind or bend over and pick up a jersey. And I got away about halfway across the field and I turned around. And he walked right past his high school jersey. He reached down and picked up number 22. And I was happy he did. I didn't tell him he had to wear it. I didn't tell him what it meant to me and the school. He understood, and he wore that jersey for 4 years. Four-time All-American.
That's a scene from a movie like Rudy or something like that. Your whole life is a damn movie. The way you tell stories, and as a journalist and a writer, I love it. It's great. Did you have any clue how 22 would become an icon of the sport?
Well, it's like a lot of jerseys, you know. The baseball numbers that we know, 3, and in Michael Jordan's number, what's that, 7 or whatever it is? 23,
yeah.
23, yeah. Many sports retire the jerseys, and it's not possible to wear them. We use number 44 in football because Jim Brown made it important, and we use it as a recruiting tool. And when we went out and looked at a great running back, we'd say, you know, if you come to Syracuse, we'd be proud to give you number 44. It takes a tough guy to want to wear it. And we have a kid right now who's he's probably the first or second high scorer this year, but he's a junior. It's taken him 2 years to get over that 22 hump to say, yeah, I'm 22, and I know I didn't do much the last couple of years because I had this jersey on my back and everybody wanted a piece of me. So it takes a special person, but Charlie Lockwood is special, you know. And in the three Powells, one of the great stories was we were playing Princeton, and Mike Powell was a senior in high school, sitting in the stands with his mother and father, witnessing the game. And it was Ryan's last game. Ryan Powell threw in a goal that tied him with Casey, and that was important. Ego-wise, you know. Ryan had thrown in the winter, and he peeled off his jersey, which was 22, and there was a lull for a face-off. You know, there was, the clock was counting down, and he peeled his jersey off, and he ran into the stands, and he threw it in Mike's lap. The mother and father on either side of him said, "There, Mike, it's yours now." And he turned around and went over to the bench and waited for the game to end. And Mike had this sweat-drenched jersey in his lap with number 22 on it. Michael put the jersey on. The rest is history. You know, he did a great job. Four-time Turnbull winner and two-time Thwarathon. Things that can't be duplicated very easily.
I mean, what an amazing family. They have lacrosse coming out their pores.
Yeah.
What was your first? What was the first time you ever heard of Casey Powell?
Well, Casey Powell was easy. He played lacrosse at Carthage High School, and they don't have an early spring, you know, and their lacrosse field was always under snow. They used to have all their games, early games, at Syracuse University on Coin Field. It was about 30 yards from my office. I could look out my window and see the Carthage bus pull up. So I saw this little kid named Casey Powell. He was
ninth grade or something?
Yeah, I mean, I said, just look at that little skinny little kid. And then out of curiosity, I'd be going home and Carthage would be playing Watertown or something, you know, not exciting lacrosse. I'd stop for a moment to see if they had anything worthwhile. And I'd see Casey just control the game. And so I knew more. I saw Casey Powell play more than any other coach. Not because I scouted a lot, because I didn't. He came to me. Not to me, but he came to Syracuse University. And I knew if I got him, he had a brother. And, oh, two brothers behind him. I might get them too. And that's an inside joke with him. I said, Casey, I really didn't want you. I wanted Ryan. And Mike was a little kid, and he would come down to Casey's games. And at halftime, he'd run out in the field and do trick sticks and throw the ball in. And everybody, I'd be in the locker room, and I'd hear the crowd roaring. I said, gee, they're not there applauding, but we're in here. We're resting. There's not a game going on. And then the crowd would roar again, and I'd say, what's that? They said, there's a little kid named Mikey Powell. He's a kid brother. He's like 9, 10 years old. He's out there doing trick sticks for the crowd. And so I said, well, I want him too.
You know, you're an interesting fella. You send out mixed messages. A lot of the times people talk about you nowadays as the father figure and not someone that would go out and chase down recruits, but let them come, you know, to you. That's kind of the image of you. But then on the inside, you know, I'm talking to Rick Beardsley, and he talks about how you took a nice little four-man plane down to get him for his recruiting trip. You really did put in a huge amount of effort for the players and cultivating the relationships from when the guys that you wanted from when they were young to come play for you.
Well, my Rick Beardsley story that it doesn't do him justice or me justice, but it's really kind of tells the truth. He's a very emotional kind of kid. You know, you can throw him off by giving him a B instead of an A, he gets sometimes a little angry. And so he came to my office one day, and he looked at me, and I forgot the issue. It had to do with academics. I think it had to do with a professor. He said, I'm out of here. I don't want to stay at this university any longer. And I could read him like a book. So I said, oh, that's too bad, Rick. What are you going to do? He said, I've got my car packed, and I'm out of here. I'll see you, Coach. Thanks for everything. And he turned around, and I said, Rick, don't let the door hit you in the ass when you're leaving. I was expected to beg him to stay, you know, and I didn't. So I'm back at my paperwork, and about an hour later, I look up, and he comes to the door, and he said, hi, Coach. I said, Rick, I thought you left us. He said, I did. And I was on Route 17, and I was heading home. And he said, I got down towards Binghamton, and I realized that my lacrosse career is over with because you're the only coach in the country that'll put up with me. And if I leave you, I'll never play lacrosse again. So he said, I'm back. So he's wonderful. He's melted into the crowd. He can run for mayor of Syracuse. He's loved here. He's a big gentle giant. He's a good father. He's a good person. You know, sometimes a little outspoken, but I could hear him and understand him, and he understood me. And
you're hitting on things that I wanted to bring up. You really are a father figure to a lot of these kids. And I want to kind of go in reverse and talk about your dad. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your dad was a real father figure for Jim Brown. And yeah. I think he was for Orrin as well. I remember you telling stories about how your dad would go talk to people out on the reservation.
All right.
Again, is that something that you just watched and learned and carried forward to all these players now?
Well, I think I was aware of what was going on. I'll tell you a great Orrin Lyons story with my dad. Orrin was in the service. He was a paratrooper in the Army, and he got out of the service, and he played box lacrosse on the reservation. He played it very well, as his father did ahead of him. And he's a great painter, a very fine painter, realistic. And he had painted some murals in this restaurant downtown Syracuse on the wall. They were murals of famous athletes from Syracuse at the time. And they surrounded this dining room on the wall. And my dad wanted to get Orrin to come to college. Only he at that point had not had his high school degree. He was a reservation kid, and that's the end of it usually. So my dad knew he'd have a hard time getting him in school academically. And so what my dad did is he went, the dean of admissions at Syracuse was a good friend of my dad's. Bill Hafer was his name. He said, Bill, let me take you to lunch one day. This is my dad talking. Bill said, sure, Sammy, I'd love to go to lunch. Where are we going? My dad said, well, I don't know. There's a little restaurant downtown I've heard a lot about. My dad looked around, and he said to Bill Hafer, gee, these are well painted, aren't they? and Bill Hafer, the dean of admissions, said, they sure are. They're wonderful. Wonderful artists must have done this. And my dad said, Bill, if a guy could paint like that, do you think he could be admitted to the Syracuse School of Fine Arts? And Bill Hafer said, oh, somebody who painted like this, I'd take him in a heartbeat. And my dad reached in his pocket, and he pulled out Orrin's application. He said, here, sign this. And that's how Orrin went to Syracuse.
So your dad had seen him play lacrosse. So he was trying to recruit him.
Yeah, I'd seen him play out on the reservation any Sunday afternoon. You'd go out there and see him play, sure.
Talk to me about that. In that era, what type of lacrosse was being played? What age groups? How frequently was that lacrosse being played? Yeah. And was it something that just your dad could go in, or was it something where a lot of people from Syracuse went and watched?
Not a lot of people went. It was a reservation, as we understand it, not really a lot of creature comfort. They had a box across in the middle of the reservation that splintered boards and chicken wire above and no grass, dirt, you know, pretty rough place to play lacrosse. And I played quite a bit of box lacrosse when I got out of school. And we had two rules. One was fighting, and the other was drawing blood. Those were the only two penalties you could get. Anything else went, and cross-checking and tripping, and it was fun to watch. It wasn't as much fun to play, but, of course, the Stoic Indians loved to play it. And my dad would take me out there, and we'd watch it. And they knew who he was. They weren't interested in college. They didn't have any background, and how were they going to pay for it and whatnot. Orrin was a little different, but he'd been in the service for a number of years, and he was married, and had a child, and you know, he knew what an education meant and if he could get one, and he had that talent that he could paint. He was straight A's through 4 years of fine arts. He majored in illustration. The original magazine, I should give you a copy, he came up when he lived in New York working for Norcross. He came up with Lacrosse Magazine, the first original Lacrosse Magazine. It only had 4 or 5 issues. He did all the covers and all the illustrations in that magazine, but they didn't have, you know, money and distribution, and it died out. But they're a beautiful magazine. But Orrin's had a lot of class because of his artwork. His senior year, he did a portrait of my dad from a photograph with a lacrosse stick in his hands with Archibald Stadium in the background. It's fabulous, fabulous portrait of my dad. He gave it to my dad as a gift, thanking him, you know, for getting him in school and helping him through school. And he all over the world, you know. He talked with the United Nations. He's spent a day with Fidel Castro. He's gone to Russia. He travels all over the world now for these greenhouses with Al Gore. Al Gore is his big buddy, you know. I mean, if there's an encampment somewhere where Indians are raising hell with dynamite and machine guns, they send for Orrin. It doesn't matter if he's on a dog or not. And Orrin will walk in through these barricades and talk peace with these guys. I can remember once up near the St. Lawrence River, Messina, there was a big conflagration up there with the state troopers and the Indians, and there was a lot of guns and a lot of potential violence, and the government said, get Orrin, get up there and talk to him. He's a peacemaker, and he demands attention, and he gets it. Life goes on. It's interesting to see what happens to your team, but my dad, you know, wooden sticks were very, very rare and hand-carved, and very few stick makers. But Onondaga Reservation, the one here, 2 miles from my house, they had a bunch of stick makers. And Gibson was one name. Lazar was another name. Hill was another name. Jacques was another name. They were well-known Indian stick makers. And if you wanted to play the game, you had to have a wooden stick. It had to be made by a stick maker. And so many of the Indians came to this reservation, Onondaga, to buy sticks. And I would want a stick, and I'd badger my dad, oh, let's go out to the reservation on a Sunday afternoon, and we could see some lacrosse, and drive by these houses, and they would do the sticks, and they'd set them out on the porch to dry. And you could drive along and see these sticks leaning against the wall on the porch. And I'd say, Dad, stop the car. We'd stop, and we'd go over and look at the sticks that were set out to dry and talk to a maker, and eventually my dad would buy me one, and all $5, you know. And I would have a real carved Indian wooden stick, and I was the envy of the neighborhood because there was no schoolboy lacrosse in Syracuse. But they'd pick up a stick, and we'd go out and play in the backyard or in the street. He'd had a few Indians, nothing of the likes of Orrin, but
His team would play them twice a year. The Onondaga Lacrosse Association wanted to play Syracuse University. And so my dad made a deal with them years ago. This is back in the 20s. We'll play two games in the spring. One, I'll bring a team out to the box and play 6-on-6, your game. And then you're going to have to come to Syracuse University, and we're going to play 10 against 10 in a field game. And so they would come to the university with their team, and they weren't used to the field. It was too long, too wide, too much running, and long sticks, and they fell apart. They were never in great shape, and the reservation would come and have a beer or two, and it was all just kind of a fiasco.
How much has the Iroquois Nationals evolved? I saw the first ever Iroquois Nationals, and like you said, they were big and husky, and they had big, long sticks, and they just kind of float in the middle of the field. They'd take whip shots from outside the box.
Guys
would run past them. In the World Indoor Championships last year, that Iroquois team is just pure speed and finesse.
Well, that's all happened in the last 10 years. You know, they developed, and Oren's been a great part of that. Oren has been their manager. And in the World Games and all those things, where they finally got acknowledged as being a separate country, they've gotten really serious about the game. I played them in 1983 at Johns Hopkins University as the defending champion. It was in June. And they had great players. The Canadian team was there. They were great. And we had a round robin at Homewood, and we won it all because we could play a 100-yard field. And the wooden stick is a brutal weapon, but it's heavy and slow. You know, I played when I got out of school. I was on a white team that played out there. My dad would have to go out there with a box team. Well, his team was all white, and they'd never played box lacrosse in their life, and they had big, heavy wooden sticks, and my dad would have to pull teeth to get six players to go out there. They were too smart to think they could go out there and have a good time, and he would go out there, and he'd play them, and they'd kick the hell out of us, and that wasn't the game that the white man knew. And so my dad was known in the reservation as a coach from the Hill, and he always had a great understanding out there, and I've always had a great understanding with the people out there.
There's one more relationship that has been really symbiotic. West Genesee High School. The number of amazing players they spit out. Are they so good, and is Messer so good because they're in the shadow of you guys and they get to watch these games and be a part of the culture? Or are you good because, you know, you started sucking up these West Jenny kids?
There wasn't schoolboy lacrosse around here until about 1950, 51, after the war, it started up again. There was a law passed in Albany, educational program, that in order to be a lacrosse coach or coach of any sport in a high school, you had to be an employee of the high school. You couldn't take somebody from the outside and bring them in. And as a result, there weren't enough coaches around, and all the high schools dropped the sport. Lacrosse. We had it here in the 20s and 30s, right up to World War II, and then it died, and there was no lacrosse. That's one reason why I went away to school, so I could play the game. West Tennessee was one of the first county schools to start lacrosse, but the people that got a jump start on everything was West Tennessee, and they got Mike Massera as a coach, and he's a taskmaster, and he knows the game, and nothing succeeds like success, you know, when you pull that jersey on. And it says West Tennessee, you know you're in for a scrap. The same with us. I always felt our jersey was worth two or three goals before we got on the field. Mike has had a great coaching staff. Most of them have been kids that played for me. Tommy Donahue, which is Kevin's brother. You know, he has a program started that's hard to beat. It goes on all summer long out there, box lacrosse.
Shove Park.
Shove Park, right. That's what they call it. And so it's easier when you got a program going. You know, I can remember John Zelberti for one. He came to my camp. I had a summer camp, and he was a munchkin. He was 7-8 years old, and the stick was bigger than he was. And he looked up at me, and he said, "Coach, I go to West Tennessee. My name's John Zelberti." I said, "Yeah, John, great program." He said, "Someday I'm going to come play for you." And I said, "Gee, John, I'll keep that in mind. You promised me I'll come." He said, "I don't want to go anywhere. I want my mom and dad to be there to see me play, and I want my friends to see me play, and, you know, I'm going to be an Orangeman." I said, "Well, that's quite a statement coming from a 7-8-year-old. Well, of course, John Zelberti came here. He was a four-time first-team All-American.
Two-time attackman of the year, right?
Yeah, but most times they'd like to play in the Carrier Dome, which is a good place to play. They'd like to be part of a tradition, which they are, from West Tennessee to Syracuse. I recruited a kid named John Desco from West Jenny. He was a midfielder, and a kid named Bill Yudovich along with him. And they came to me, and they were big and strong and fast, and I made defensemen out of them. They both wound up being All-Americans. It was the start of my program, really, with John Desco and Bill Yudovich, and then Kevin Donahue was with them at West Tennessee at that time. So that's how I got my start, was West Tennessee. Nobody recruited up here.
Coach Messer was feeding you this incredible talent, but his style of play and his style of coaching seemed to be so different.
Right.
They still go with the socks up and they're in formation and doing the same drills.
Oh yeah.
What was your relationship with Messer? I mean, how did those different styles mesh in the whole recruiting process?
You know, Mike has never been to my house and I've never been to his. We socially never mingled in any way whatsoever. I never ran into him in a tailgate or parking lot. I've seen him in games. We're cordial to one another. I shake his hand, he shakes mine. He's had a lot of kids making a name for themselves playing for Syracuse, and yeah, they still get off that bus a double file, lockstep, like Marines. They're not allowed to talk, look left or right. They're all business. He has a formula. He has a winning formula. He has a big program from middle school to junior high school. He's got great coaches, and all the bad and the ugly are gone by the time Mike gets them. By the time Mike gets them, they're all hand-picked and well-drilled, and they know exactly what they have to do and why they have to do it.
It's amazing that the two programs developed side by side like that when they're so different.
Yeah,
so what happens with a guy like John Zilberti, who under you, he blows up into this personality as much as just insane skills.
Yeah.
What was he like in high school? Did he bring that discipline of Messer and feed that into your team?
He brought no discipline from home. Go out to his house. They had three spigots that drained into the sink in the kitchen, hot and cold water and beer. And they had a barrel of beer under the sink. Discipline? No, John's not that way. John's a joy. You know, John is a treasure. And everybody knows that. Mike Messer loves John. And he's a Pied Piper. The kids love him. He does camps. And he's got a following. He's got a personality. He's wonderful. But when he was in school, yeah, he was difficult. There are many times when I'd call a timeout and say, John, don't get in the huddle. I can't stand the smell of stale beer. Please step back. John's a treasure. I'm happy to say he's a Syracusan.
I don't think you'll be able to do this with one item, but in a couple items, what are your favorite pieces of SU lacrosse memorabilia, treasures that you've got in your house?
I have Jim Brown's stick, the last stick he had.
Wow.
That he signed for me, because I always kept his sticks alive, stringing-wise or cracks filled with fiberglass. I have my father's stick that he had in college. I had a stick my father bought me when I was a kid that I learned on.
What was it, the lemon wood? Was it the British?
Yeah, no, I did. When I was in boys' school, I had an English stick made of lemon wood.
Yeah.
And the thought was that a wooden bow, when you pull it back, it bends. It doesn't break. It bends, and then it has a memory factor. When you let go of the string, the wood goes back to where it was. So this guy made sticks in England, lemon wood. Our wooden stick, as we know it, is always hickory. Because hickory is the toughest wood we have here. There's very little, you know. You've been here enough to know there are no trophies and no plaques on the wall. I'm very proud of my Hall of Fame and, you know, a couple of other awards I've had. They're around here somewhere, but they're not hanging. A lot of people come to my house for the first time and they expect to walk into a trophy room. And, of course, it would be if I kept everything. The important ones, of course, I've kept. As you know, in my kitchen, I got a pile of sticks in the corner. Right now, Syracuse University Library has a big glass case, and they're doing a 100-year celebration of lacrosse at Syracuse, and they have sticks from the 1860s up to yesterday. Well, keep up your journalistic efforts. I have a good friend and neighbor here. He just walked in, and the way I I kept him here and kept him quiet. I threw him your article, and he's about page two.
We have spilled a lot of ink on this 100th anniversary, but it's been awesome.
I just feel like I think I said the other night, they gave me a pile of stones and said, make a cathedral. And all I did was make a foundation. And the rest has to be built later on. And I'm here in the wings watching it being built. And I sit up in the little perch. And as my dad did, he was in the stands and I was on the sideline. And my oldest boy was on the field. And life goes on. We're blessed that we have good health, good sport, good following, a great university to play for, great sport to play in. And I'm a lucky guy. A real lucky guy. And I can't thank you enough for believing in our 100th and in me and the program and the game. Thank you, Robert. And if you were here, I'd give you a hug too. Okay?
Yeah, great to talk to you. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
And I'll do a little closing here, just thanking everybody for joining us for this special edition of this Inside Lacrosse podcast. We are here celebrating the Syracuse 100th anniversary with Coach Roy Simmons Jr.